Hi, and welcome to Blend With Us. Today we have another treat. We have Google employee, Patrick Martin.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
I guess you're from the Bay Area right now.
I'm actually out in Colorado, so...
Oh, very nice.
Remote to a lot of other Firebasers.
So where are the other Firebase developers based?
They're kind of all over. A lot of the people I work with are out in the Bay Area, like Sunnyvale. But you know, there's New York and Waterloo offices. I know are big. There are others.
Mm-hmm. And you've quite a few. You've been a developer for about what, same time as me, I think, about 14 years or something like that.
Yeah. I graduated in 2009, and I've been doing something game-related ever since.
Open City Table, working on website and graphic design, Venon Entertainment.
Yeah, so Venon is a mobile game studio, which was kind of my first post-graduating, or first job I got after graduating. The Tabernacle is just my high school job, so yeah.
And you worked for 6 years at Sphero?
Yep. They're a robot toy company. So I joined them when there were like, you know, 20-ish developers as a small startup, and we eventually made like a toy for Disney, Sphero's BB-8, and like kind of exploded in size for a while.
I'm just looking at their little Sphero, yeah. RVR thing, which is holding toilet paper and Lego and a lighter.
Oh yeah, that's great. I have one right off to the side of me. That was the actually my own pitch in one of our company. We do Sphero Spa Week, where like everybody inside the company could pitch, and that was actually one of mine that took off. Unfortunately, I left before it was finished, but I still managed to get one.
And now you're a developer advocate at Google. What does a developer advocate do?
It's kind of funny. Every time you ask someone, you'll get a slightly different answer. But the general gist of it is that, the description I like best is that I advocate for developers inside of Google. And that's also some outreach. So, you know, I make a lot of tutorial videos and stuff. If you look at the official Firebase Unity documentation, the videos you see embedded there are all mine. But then I also go out to trade shows and whatnot and find out, kind of what issues developers have with the product, and I try to bring those back in and drive the direction in some way, if I can.
So what is the back-end Firebase core libraries, database drivers written in?
There are two parts to that. There's like the server side, and there's the client. I don't actually know what a lot of the server engineers are writing in. For the client, especially what I focus on, since I focus on games, you're looking at C++ for kind of the main layer many game developers will see. And then built on top of that is a Unity SDK written in C#. But the for both iOS and Android, there are actually, native layers to each of those like operating systems written in like Objective-C and Java for their respective platforms.
Yeah, there's so much layers on technology and libraries. It's a huge project. How many developers do you think are working on actual core SDKs and infrastructure for Firebase?
I mean, I honestly don't really have that much of a handle on that because I'm remote. It's like I sometimes see the games team when I'm out in the Bay Area, but like I haven't even been to all of our offices. So
yeah, I think it originally was kind of a smally startup, and then it got acquired.
I could be getting this wrong because I've only been there for like a year.
Yeah,
but I believe it was actually like a startup. acquired by Twitter, then like sold off and, or spun off and sold to Google.
Yeah.
So could have that wrong. It might just be a thing under Firebase that went through that, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm building a YouTube video series called Svelte Full Stack Starter. Svelte's a front end framework, but I started off using different technology, Netlify, but I found that Firebase was just, and I wanted to add different adapters for different backends, but then I just kind of stuck with Firebase because it did the authentication really well. Then I got kind of like, took me a while to get the hang of writing in a NoSQL database because I'm used to SQL databases. And having like all the stuff like joins for free, and then have to think about how I'm going to pull the data out, various paths and childs in the Firebase. But I like the flexibility of NoSQL. I'm not actually using any real time database. I'm just using like dot ones to get the data out, and I'm trying to use it like SQL database as much as I can.
Yeah, cool. It's great you like it. Yeah, it's funny. I come from very much a, I guess, games front end engineering background. So, when I'd used Firebase before joining Firebase, the primary like selling point for me was that I didn't have to worry about a lot of that. Like, if you sit me in front of documentation, I can figure out a SQL query, but I really don't want to. It's like just throw some structs at me and I'll make a graphics happen. I don't know.
Yeah, I did SQL for about 4 or 5 years, and then I went into pure front end development and basically didn't really lost a lot of touch with the back end stuff. But where I want to go, I want to try and make some web products, see if I can pull it off. But it's tough, you know, when you're earning a stable wage, it's hard to dedicate time into a startup. Hearing so many statistics about how many startups fail.
Oh yeah. Yeah, no, I've been through like the Venon closing down with me in it, and that's it's always a hard thing. And I know that at least in the game side, I think in general, more companies close than don't.
Yeah. Even in London, they're talking about like the tech scene is like really worried that a whole bunch of startups are going to get wiped out.
Yeah. I mean, it's always hard. It's there's less, you know, job security in a startup or something, but I find it, they're really, really fun to be a part of. Like, I don't know. I got so used to, because I've always worked at small companies before Google and, like, you know, one startup, one small game studio. And I love kind of the, amount of reach you get, right? Like, because there are so few people that like, you have to wear many hats no matter what. Like, even as a software engineer, I am helping with game design. And, you know, I ended up writing the audio system because who else is going to write the audio system? Yeah. And just like being able to do that was really cool.
I've been working really hard today. I've just come off another podcast.
Yeah.
But I'm just I've got an extra 2 hours a day because I'm not commuting. So when I'm in London, I'm commuting. It takes me about 2 hours extra, an hour and a half. But so I can really focus on these podcasts right now.
You know, I've joined the great internet cohort of amateur sourdough bakers now.
Yeah.
Now that I don't have the commute and slightly more time. I'd been baking bread before, but being unable to find store-bought yeast, I finally took the dive and started making my own culture.
Yeah, I like this camera angle where it's like at 45 degrees to where you're looking. It's like I'm looking at a Twitch streamer, but I'm getting instant interaction. I feel special, you know?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, it's the only place I can put the camera. Like, this is my own camera. I'm not using, like, my whatever video team issued thing over there. Yeah, it's like the only place that fits in my office.
That's a big setup you got in that room, man.
Yeah, no, it's mildly intimidating. I'm like afraid to touch it unless I'm on a video call with like our video team.
So
But hopefully, what was that?
you have people doing that video for you?
So I get directed. Like I'm basically their puppet for setup. So
Right.
like, there's a microphone, teleprompter, and like a camera in there, and there's like a light kit. It's just so that our videos still kind of look nice while we're all staying at home.
Yeah.
Because a hard thing about being a developer advocate and remotely, like out in Colorado, is that there isn't a recording studio out here. So normally I have to fly anyway out to the Bay Area or one of the other offices with the studio. And it may like, of course, with all the lockdowns and stuff, that's just not feasible right now.
Yeah. So how are you finding the lockdown in Colorado?
I mean, kind of lucky. I mean, not lucky to be locked down, but especially talking with coworkers, I have a house with like a yard, which can be rare in more like city areas. So, I'm kind of lucky in that I get a backyard, so my kid and my dog can run around, and they're still, a little more hyper than usual since like we can't go out on like long walks in like national parks or anything, but we're at least not completely trapped inside like an apartment or something that a lot of my city dwelling friends are. But otherwise, yeah, it's a bummer.
So I tried to make a 3D RTS game on YouTube, but I got kind of sidetracked with like life. But if I was trying to understand how to make two sort of chessboards sync across the positions of objects and then have like a bit smooth so that it's like you can predict things where things are moving around like in this sort of world variables backend server, I guess is that kind of stuff that you think about with your game developments?
Yeah, I mean, you start describing that and I'm trying to like, picture what you're doing like in my head just implicitly. So, but yeah, I guess if you how would you like me to answer that question? So, yeah, I think about that sort of thing a lot.
Yeah, I mean, how do you predict movements whilst not like being inaccurate? And I guess players think they've
All
got a
right.
degree of precision, but I guess a lot of that precision is sort of, there's probably a 4 or 5% hitbox of where sometimes the person might be on target or might not be on target.
Yeah. So you're just talking about like network latency or like physical accuracy of a player, like whether or not they can click on a thing versus the player's client being out of sync versus the server.
Well, in terms of say you've got somebody
Yeah.
in the UK versus somebody in
Right.
the
All right,
US.
so like server latency.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean depending on the game, how you correct for that sort of thing is very different.
Yeah.
Like if you're looking at more this so you said RTS, so it doesn't quite apply as much.
Yeah.
If you're looking at kind of more of an action-y game, like a first person shooter or like, I don't know, Escape Velocity or something. You typically you kind of always have two states that you're dealing with and trying to rectify. There's the state that the player thinks they're in, and there's the last state that the player got from the server. And the whole trick is smoothly interpolating from one to the other, right? So that's like, I mean that's a hard thing. Generally, game engines like Unity and Unreal hide a lot of that for you,
Right.
but you usually end up in this state where the player thought they were walking, or more often with the like player's enemy, right? You thought the enemy was going in one direction over some amount of time. You get a server sync that said actually they turned to the left,
Yeah.
and you usually do something where you have like these two data points and you start linearly or start interpolating over time, like various algorithms to do that that are
There's quite a
or
few of those
worse.
algorithms I've seen.
Yeah. No, for this stuff I've worked on, so again, like for this sort of thing, mostly indie games and like student games, I've done just the trivial linear interpolation between like where the player thinks they are and where the server said they should be.
Yeah.
So actually, if I were to rewind this and play like playback, is I've loaded all this data into my local cache, so to say. Typically, like when you're playing, let's say you're just like two characters moving around or something. What you'll send over the wire is the position and then like the velocity, right? Or like maybe the position and the current inputs on the controller or something to infer what the player was trying to do. And it could be multiple like tens or hundreds of milliseconds before the next update. And like, a game frame happens like every, what, like 33 milliseconds or something like that. Over the time that you're not getting any updates, you'll just be going from the last position you got, like following along that velocity they had. And eventually you'll get like another position and another velocity. What you'll have to do is kind of have like a fudging value that over the next like say half a second to a second, you interpolate from like one to the other. So like you kind of have this thing where you're all, and then like you can get more sophisticated by saying we're this many milliseconds apart as far as our average ping. So this was actually the position back then. So step that forward. So you're always in like this state of catch up. You always have to be cognizant of how do you represent that. Like if you start getting like shooting in. When you shoot, you could like some games. I believe Unreal Tournament 99 actually had a packet that was like, somebody hit you, like right. So I could say so. I say at my client side, hey, I think I hit you, which feels really good for me playing, but is also like ripe for abuse. So like you could actually kill somebody, record that packet, and play it back, and just kill them over and over and over. And like that's one way to solve it. And then on the other end, you could just be like, I don't know, it's whatever the server says, and you just try to build into the gameplay something that doesn't make it feel like you're being cheated.
So would you say that most games, online games, have a central server, or is there some sway towards peer-to-peer game servers?
Typically, I think you see central servers a lot more. So I should say that like most of the multiplayer games I've personally worked on have been mobile games, and they were like old, like like iPhone 3G ones. And you would typically establish a local connection of some kind, but one of the players would be the host, which just simplifies logic a lot because basically your architecture becomes like the hosts become sort of a relay. So everybody sends their inputs and stuff to the host, and then the host tells everybody like where they are and what everyone's doing. And there's no sort of like negotiation. When you get a message coming down, you just know you have to rectify yourself to whatever that message is. If you do a peer-to-peer thing, you have to like agree on stuff, right? You start shouting out what you're doing, and you just like take that client at their word. Or like if I think I hit you but you don't think I hit you, we have to like figure out how to negotiate that transaction. So like a more like distributed network doesn't work well for a lot of games. And then especially now with like the prevalence of I guess cheaper dedicated server hosting systems. Like, obviously, I talk to the Google Cloud gaming team a lot. So there's like the Google Cloud hosted game servers, but there's similar offerings from like Amazon and Microsoft that just like they let you spin up a dedicated game server in the cloud, and it's like geographically close to your players. You don't have to worry about, forwarding ports and such as much. It's generally just really convenient to spin up a server on like in an environment you have more control over.
So is this a server starting up because, say, 10 people are starting a game and a server will spin up like virtually or then shut down when the game's finished kind of deal?
Yeah, so that what I can talk about most, just because I've talked to the people who use it more, is like the Google Cloud Game Servers, which I think just entered beta. But their whole thing is there's a offering called Egoni. I'm going to pronounce all of these wrong, so apologies to you and your listeners. But it's built on top of Kubernetes, so and with something called OpenMatch. So the idea with this particular stack is that you register like, hey, I'm a player and I would like to play a game, and the developer using the Google Cloud Game Servers would have some sort of matching function that they provide, like maybe based on skill or maybe based on like just how close you are to another player or something. And what once enough like players enter this like matching service, open match, to be able to create a game, a dedicated server will be spun up as like a Kubernetes instance. So spun up in Docker, and all these players will be thrown over to that server and they can play until the game's over. And then, you know, bounce back out to open match or whatever to start the next game eventually. That's just like one architecture of many you could choose, but that's the one that the Google Cloud team is working on right now.
Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about like central servers and peer-to-peer, would games sometimes like, I don't know, maybe like World of Tanks, people will get into a game and they'll find 10 players. Are you saying that it's possible that instead of a central server that the games company owns providing all the updates, one player is picked as the central hub where all the other players sort of, in a sense, you're hijacking their computer, turning it into a server.
So that historically, that's how a lot of games used to be, right? Like, if you're like, I played a lot of Counter-Strike. I actually played competitively back in high school, and the thing there would be that you would say, you would like enter, you would get like a menu and you could either host or join a game. And if you clicked host, your computer just broadcast out to like a central server directory, hey, there's a player here hosting a server, go connect to it. And you can get like multiple levels of sophistication around that. You can get multiple levels of sophistication around that. Like maybe you join a party and like you choose amongst yourself, like the game can choose in the background who the host is, like maybe the person who has the best ping times between other players. Uh-huh. But historically, something like that where a player in your group would get chosen to host, that used to be common. Especially in larger games, the typical process is to spin up a server on hardware that the company controls, like the game studio. And like, you know, controls is loose. Like, you know, it could be that they go to something like the Google managed game servers, or they could go to something like Multiplay, where like they'll distribute it onto like whatever cloud service is most convenient and do like mix that with on-prem. But generally it seems to be preferred to host on hardware you control in some way.
I guess there are definitely harder to hack, right? Because it's harder to cheat.
It's probably partially that, harder to hack, more control. I'm sure part of it is also just that like you'll get better internet connection there than you might have at home. Like I do distinctly remember being on having like one of my ISPs when I was like living in a more rural area out here that just completely throttled upstream. They would see me like uploading data and they'd just be like, nope, you're trying to host a server. That's not cool. So I'm sure you get around things like those. And it makes it easier to deal with like weird networking conditions. Like, if like someone has like a really strict firewall or something, as long as you can see the game server and communicate with that, that's all that's needed, rather than like having to somehow establish a direct connection with each player.
Yeah. Do you follow any of the IO games on the web? The .io games?
What?
So like Agar and Slither, those kind of games, are you familiar with them?
I do not believe so.
There's some interesting games called there's like one called I think it's Deep.io, where it's like you get these little tanks that shoot these circular blobs, but there's on the in the actual game there can be something like there must be, because everybody can shoot a whole bunch of them at once, these little circles, and the whole map there must be about at one time like 100,000 particles at once. So I'm thinking there's no way that that amount of data can be shared down, all the time. So they must have some clever algorithm that only shares the data that's in your range. Sort of like a quad tree, I guess.
Yeah, there are like tricky ways to do things like that, right? Because and like I guess I tried going to the URL you said and it said like 502 down, but oh, what's this one?
Deep is DIEP.io or DIEP. EIP.io. One of them is basically a website that tells you about the website because they know people are going to misspell it,
Oh yeah, look at that. Yeah, no, there are ways to like let me close this before I mess up the recording. There are different ways to handle large numbers of people, right? Like the Flappy Royale group. I know what they did because they used Firebase for some of it and wrote like a paper on it, so I got excited and read it. But they actually like pre-recorded gameplay and put it into like a cloud storage bucket, and it seemed like you're matched with random people you're playing with, but you're really just matched against a whole bunch of replays that was like distributed in a really efficient manner. You can do things like octrees or other spatial enumeration like tricks. And then let's see. I know a fun thing that Eve did for Eve Online is that each star system is, if I understand it correctly, each star system is like a different kind of virtual server, and they move around on like physical hardware units. So like if a bunch of people start like doing a thing on one system, it will first start moving other star systems off of that machine. And then once they can't do that anymore, they'll actually slow down the simulation time to give them more time to deal with processing all the data.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I remember my first job as a programmer, I was talking to one of the boss at the time, and I was saying, do you think that computer games are, basically we were writing software, and the software was like, I was writing software to replace software that they were paying money for, and the software that they were paying money for was like £30,000 or something. And I was basically writing a plugin for a free software, and I was saying to him, how come like this software we write is so much more expensive than this computer game software, that's like just like £5, but I guess it's because you're selling a whole bunch of them versus like 10. But he was interested that the algorithms in games are much more complicated than scientific software, like we were writing. The algorithms are just so clever.
Yeah, you know, it's like it's funny because I think part of it is that like game development is such like a passion driven thing. Like I've it's been extra work for me to whenever I need to find a new job or something to make sure I stay like games or games related. But it's like such a driving force that you kind of want to work on all those things. But also like the really, I guess the other really interesting thing is that games problems are also so much more different, like especially consumer games, right? Because I remember talking to a serious games company, and they're talking about how, a game they got contracted to make, like the government just bought them Humvees, and they're like, if our game's running slow, it's probably going to be cheaper to just like buy a bigger machine and shove it in the back of the Humvee than to really optimize it down. Whereas a lot of game developers, especially like mobile developers, like you have to deal with the fact that a lot of people are probably going with their free phone, their ISP just gives them, or like they got the free phone like 5 years ago and they just keep using it. So you have to like really, really optimize in really wacky ways to get the same bang for your buck out. And that's where you start, like, because you're moving that optimization layer and like I guess that algorithmic complexity into a position where it's like, it's corrected for in the market or whatever. Like, market forces will start like super seriously driving that innovation in crazy ways.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated behind the tech of computer games and the algorithms, and but what I'm worried is that it's like it seems like there's a lot of sway in the industry to try and get people addicted as much as possible in games, and I'm worried about social impact of a lot of this, the online games in particular. There's a lot of people that. I mean, I would find it hard to work as a game developer, I think, because just because if I was writing a game, people are hired to make it addictive. I would just like, because I've been approached by gaming companies, like it's been gambling companies. I just say, look, I'm not going to work on that kind of stuff, even if you pay me, How do you.
Oh yeah, no, I totally get it because like I kind of I joined the games industry before kind of the free to play era really took off. Like my first mobile game that I worked on cost $10 in the iOS App Store, and like if you ship a game for that much now, it's like basically a no-go. No one's gonna buy that. But it's interesting because like games are always like designed to kind of be fun and kind of be like time wasters, right? Like but at the same time you can kind of have that tilted more towards good and more towards evil, like just about anything. Like I think the amazing thing I've been seeing recently now that everybody's stuck in self-isolation is that I've noticed so many people playing like Mario Kart and Animal Crossing now. Like friends of mine who like never touch games are having meaningful social interactions by like jumping on a voice channel and then playing some Mario Kart.
Yeah, some of my developers actually that are they were trying to get me to play Mario Kart, but I don't have a Switch, and I'm actually very very busy. So the one time I game, I'll probably sit a couple of hours on a Sunday and play some online thing like Deep, But I know if I go back to those games like World of Tanks and stuff, I mean, I kind of pick on that because it would just affect me too much because I wouldn't be able to operate like as a programmer if I was playing games.
It's I mean the thing I would say is a I'm a career game developer, so I'm just about as biased as you can get for having an opinion on these. But there's this book I've started reading and admittedly have mostly read parts of, and it's been on my reading list called Homo Ludens. It's Dutch, I believe. Country Netherlands. And it's like really old. 1938 it was published, but it starts out by proposing that play, like the act of playing, can in some form can be observed in pretty much any member of like the kingdom Animalia, right? So like pretty much every animal has something that resembles play, and that like it's for better or for worse kind of core to core to not only the human experience, but like the experience of like almost every species on the planet, as far as, again, animals. Obviously, I don't want to discriminate too much against trees. They do really cool things. But so in some ways, in some ways, I sometimes feel really bad when I spend like a weekend just gaming, which I can do if left unchecked. But in other ways, it's like when I think about what I'm doing in gaming, even compared to like other mediums, it's like I'm like encountering puzzles and working around them. And in many cases, these puzzles are some form of role playing, right? Like even something like Animal Crossing, it's like I'm kind of role playing different, like simulated social situations, or like you could even get more ridiculous, like something like Spy Party, where if you haven't played that game, it's really funny. It's like a 2-player competitive game where one person's a spy in a party, and the other person's a sniper, and the sniper has to snipe the spy before like they complete their mission or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like you're kind of role playing fitting in like a party, which is kind of silly, but it's also, you know, something we're kind of always doing, right? Like trying to fit in and stuff. And it's really interesting way to I don't know, push those buttons in like a less dire, I don't know. This metaphor is falling apart, but I find that I'm getting something out of gaming no matter how ridiculous it is.
It'd be interesting to see what money goes into esports now that we're real sports are all pretty much dead in the water right now.
Yeah, no. The interesting thing is like esports do the arena thing too. So I haven't been keeping up with like what Overwatch League has been doing, which is the last one I followed. But it seems like it would be really weird if there wasn't a cheering audience. But the really interesting thing with esports is that depending on the game, so whenever I've followed sports, it's been a sport I played. So like I used to play tennis in high school, so I would watch a lot of tennis matches to kind of see how professionals react in different situations.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Yeah.
I love tennis.
It's been a while. I still have my old high school downstairs in my basement. I'm like, nice. One day I'm going to get it restrung, put some new grip tape on it, and head back out. just like the piano down there that I'm totally going to play again one day.
I actually love on a Saturday going to the tennis courts, the Ashes Turf tennis courts, and spending like playing like 5 hours solid and not taking breaks like the pros do every two games.
Yeah, no, I used to, when I was big into it, just like all the time, I would, like in high school, I was like really weird. I'd program a lot and play tennis. I'd just like walk around the house, like bouncing the ball, or like go outside and hit against the wall. It's just like, yeah. But yeah, no, what was I saying? Oh yeah, that's what's... The reason why I like esports too is just that it maybe like in a different way they'll get bigger, and that I like watching esports for games I play. Like I watched a lot of Heroes of the Storm when I played a lot of Heroes of the Storm, partially for that same thing. Like I can see what strategies I might want to adopt, albeit poorly, and it's also I can follow it much better since like you know I imagine myself in like the heads of the pro players. It's like maybe with people staying at home and playing more video games, they'll take off just because everyone relates to it more. They're being less confused by all like the shiny particle effects in League of Legends or something.
Yeah. What games do you play on? Which are confusing.
What games do I play?
Yeah. Or,
yeah. So right now I'm until I had to set up this home studio, I was playing Half-Life Alyx, which my computer can barely run. Like I get a pop-up warning every time I launch it saying, hey, your computer is not powerful enough, but it works and it's fun. And then I've also been playing a lot of Ori and the Will of the Wisps. And then of course, kind of the games that my various social friend groups have picked up. So Animal Crossing, especially when, you know, people want to come over and sell their turnips or something. And then the Mario Kart has happened a lot, and also one gaming group, it's like a group of friends I have that we dispersed all over the country after we graduated from college. We've been starting to pick up Left 4 Dead again, which is awesome because everybody's computer can run it since it's so old.
What kind of game's that?
Left 4 Dead. It's a first-person shooter. That's a the way we play is a four-player co-op. You can also do a 4v4. It's kind of like a zombie survival game. So you start in like one side of the level, and you have to get to the other, and there are a bunch of zombies that are trying to stop you. But
Oh,
it's
okay.
made by Valve. It's, I think, really well designed. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, what age are you, so if I can sort of remember what games I used to play when I was, well, what's the earliest? What? How old are you?
32.
Okay, so you were a Mario, Sonic the Hedgehog, that kind of stuff. I'm
Yep.
35. Yeah,
My
PlayStation.
first console was a Genesis.
Yeah,
So.
me too.
Cool. Yeah. You know, I still have not my original Genesis because I've moved across the country enough times that I've like gotten rid of all my old stuff.
Yeah.
But I do have a Genesis downstairs now that I love playing. And actually it's funny now that I have a kid, I've noticed that she really likes right now the older games because, you know, they're simpler. So it's like
Oh, really?
the Genesis, like especially Atari's, because like, you know, it's a giant joystick and a single button.
Yeah.
It's much easier for like a kid to pick up than like, you know, handing them a even like a Switch controller.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I was quite lucky, I think, because I didn't have a console until I was like 10. So a lot of times I was just going to my friend's house, which made it really kind of special. I really enjoyed playing when I was at my friend's, but actually when I had my own console, I think I enjoyed games less.
Yeah, no, that's like I remember being a kid with like probably through the N64 era. Like I always had siblings. So games to me were always a social thing, and I like never played single player campaigns in games ever. Like all of my memories of like Sonic 2 are just with like the split screen two player racing thing. Like I
Yeah.
don't think I've made it past I don't think I made it past the chemical zone until I was like an adult.
Yeah, drowning.
yeah
Still get nightmares that music
oh
probably.
yeah oh man, what game was it? So my wife has been playing Banjo Kazooie on like Rare Replay on the three on the Xbox One, so like the 360 version. And whenever she is in the underwater levels, I queued up that music and started playing it. And yet she hasn't divorced me.
There's several games that I've actually not just uninstalled from my phone. I actually contacted the developers and says delete my account because I couldn't stop playing it. There was one of them was Clash Royale, and I tried to install it again, but they did a good job of deleting it because like no matter what phone I use, if I use my iTunes, it's banned my account permanently, you know. So even when I'm tempted to go back to it, it's but basically I have one of my friends and he's got it. So when I see him every few weeks, I'll jump on that tablet and play that game. But it's I think there's a certain percentage of people that find it hard to sort of play in moderation.
Yeah. No, like, I wouldn't even claim that I'm good at moderation. It's just for me that the barrier of entry of starting up some of my favorite games is kind of high. Like if I'm gonna play Ori and the Will of the Wisps, I need to fire up the Xbox because it doesn't run on my poor old gaming machine now.
Yeah.
Which means that it needs to be a time when I'm not gonna get yelled at by a toddler for turning off, I don't know, whatever we're using to entertain her now that we're stuck inside all day.
Yeah. But
And then, yeah.
because I'm gaming, I'm programming so much, I find that if I do go and start gaming, I don't have as much focus on my actual work. 'Cause I mean, game developers must come if they love their games so much, but how do they become good, keep staying good programmers if they like to game? Because obviously it's taking their time away from technology.
Yeah, no, that's hard. Like I went to school for game development. I went to a school called DigiPen, and that was actually in our freshman orientation. One of the professors was like, "Look, everyone here is a gamer. You have to be very careful because whenever you're going to be stressed, you're going to start playing games, and college is going to stress you out. So literally, everyone here, if they're not careful, is just going to end up playing games until they drop out."
Yeah.
Which. You know, it's just something. I think what happened to me is through college, I just built up such a extreme amount of guilt when I was doing anything other than like programming that that forced me to play in moderation, like the balance between that. And then eventually I did pick up other hobbies again.
Yeah, I think probably the best game programmers probably not actually gamers.
Yeah, or at least someone who can like thread the needle, right? Like I'm still a gamer, like as we've probably established, but I don't
Yeah.
think I'm really as much of a core gamer as I used to be. Like I literally have not fired up Red Dead Redemption, which like probably is sacrilege to a lot of my friends. But it's just I don't have times for like a lot of big systems games, and kind of forcing myself to the smaller indie experiences means that maybe there'll be a month where I don't do any programming on the side because I'm like obsessed with various games, but then I'll switch back and be like, I don't know, being
Yeah.
very indecisive about game engines again.
It's interesting how they're hiring a so-called, based on my limited knowledge of that US Army, they're hiring gamers to pilot drones. Is that true? I think.
I don't know. So I will say that I have not followed this closely,
Yeah.
but I remember reading one article saying that they were doing that, then another article saying that they stopped because gamers did not have the attention span. But because, you know, generally,
Yeah.
generally it can be boring to just like, you know, going in on patrol and nothing happens. But I don't know how accurate either of those are.
I think that warfare typically had a man in the machine, and then this the evolution of that is man on a controller piloting it from distance. But then that period of time might be pretty short as people military goes to more AI type things if the human performance isn't up to speed with, and I think that a lot of future warfare will be fought for with AI because the response times will be so quick. And I mean, US military is thinking of getting rid of all the tanks by 2030 so they can fight like with drones and whatnot.
It's a thing. I don't know, like I've kind of purposefully stayed out of military projects. I don't know quite what's going on with any of those, but
Yeah, I remember one of
it
my
but
first.
it yeah it, the funny thing is that there is a lot of like I've talked to serious games developers in the past. There is a lot of crossover between, I guess, games work and the military. It's just, I mean, I used to work with someone who worked on America's Army, so there's like a lot there in all sorts of levels, but I haven't experienced it.
Yeah, I guess they're using some sort of, I think some kind of first person shooter games to train infantry. And I guess with like, if you want to be a tank diver, World of Tanks would be a good game to play because I was playing that game a lot when I was walking about fields and stuff. I was sort of thinking about, well, that would be a good spot to hide behind and all this stuff. Your mind starts to think like a tank driver.
Yeah, no, when I was playing Call of Duty a lot, it was, I can't say how accurate it was because I don't know how much like, you know, crouching in a bush matches like, you know, real world experience, but definitely there was a time when my brain was always thinking like, oh no, I'm out in the open. This person there are all these cross lines of sight to me.
Oh, there's a car, I can steal it and drive it, you know.
Oh yeah, there's definitely a time when what was it? I think it was Burnout 2. The first song that always played when you fired up was "Lazy Generation" by the F-Ups, and like I had a hard time not speeding whenever that song started playing in my car.
Yeah, when I first before I started my driving lessons, I got an Xbox and I had Project Gotham Racing, and actually that kind of prepared me for like real driving, because I was like almost taking the racing line into the yeah. roundabouts, and the instructor's like, "Hey, we're not racing here."
Oh yeah, no, it's the one thing that probably saved me there is that I play a lot of like arcade racers, so the drift doesn't quite work the same there as in real life. It'd be funny to try to like pull the handbrake in my car and see how poorly I react IRL.
Yeah. Cool. So we're not talking much about Firebase, haven't we? It's all interesting talking.
Yep.
Cool. So what's life working at Google?
It's interesting. It's probably going to be different like for everyone you talk to, but since my role is a lot of interacting with, I guess, the developer community. So the two really weird things are, like, one, I'm remote from the rest of my team, so that's a big change, that like all my meetings are over like video chat and stuff. But also because I have to meet with the community and stuff, I travel much more than I used to. Other places, like I was actually in London in January before everything locked down, and then I think I got one more event out in the Bay Area before I wasn't allowed to travel around. So it's really fun. I like get to go out and meet people at conferences a lot, which is really really cool. Since the last place I worked, I was literally under a staircase, kind of in a little closet area. So getting out to actually see people and interact with like other engineers is like really super cool, especially around the world. I was also in Madrid.
You know, you could carry a mic around with you and do podcasting if you're allowed to do that. I don't know.
There's definitely some other DAs in the org do have podcasts of some kind, but it's a lot of work.
It does take a lot of work. it is a lot of work, but I just enjoy the process. It's very rewarding because you have something that you can listen to, and I used to listen to quite a few different podcasts on iTunes, but I've kind of like unsubscribed from most of them now, and I just listen to my own stuff, and it's like weird, you know, like,
you know. I get a kick out of a lot of the podcasts I listen to kind of get a little weedsy technical. Like they're usually a lot of them are people nerding out about a thing they like. And since one of the things they like is podcasting, I get like some inside baseball of how like different podcasts are put together. I'm always like, hey, I think I could kind of do this. I've heard everybody else kind of working through problems and after shows and stuff. I should try to pick it up.
Having a tech podcast is great fun because there's so much stuff you can talk about, and it's always new things to talk about, and people always want to come on the show like to talk about their tech stuff. It's quite it's quite a low barrier to entry, but yeah, it also, you can learn a lot. So like we're called like Learn With Us because like, I'm learning a lot from this podcast. It's like free consulting for like an hour. And I talk about stuff I'm interested in, so from experts. So for me, it's a no-brainer to keep doing. And I've got my editing process down to like an hour to record.
Oh, wow.
An hour to edit. An hour to edit and publish, you know, much, yeah.
I wish it was that fast for me to record my getting started video.
Takes a whole bunch, a lot of time longer. I mean, I haven't even thought about doing video for these podcasts because I just know it'll take me three times longer to do properly. And if you don't do it properly, it's going to just look like everybody else's Skype videos on YouTube, you know?
Yeah.
I've added one thing well and have the audio well, so.
You know, a funny thing, like hopefully in the coming weeks you'll see the videos I've just recorded. But there was like a good half an hour to an hour where they just had me like rearranging stuff on the shelves behind me to try to make it look more. It's like, oh, now like the frame's a little out of balance. Like move that Star Wars helmet over again or something.
How do people find you to see your videos?
So I kind of cheat in that Almost every video I've recorded is embedded in the Firebase documentation somewhere.
Oh, okay.
And there aren't many of them. So like I've done, let's see, what have I got done so far? There's like getting started with Unity and Firebase. I did a cloud storage just for Android. Then real-time database. Did I do anything else? I don't even know the stuff I've worked on.
Hey, your employees listen to this podcast, man.
Yeah. No, I haven't. Where'd you find me? This is a terrible choice.
Yeah. I guess your videos on YouTube and stuff, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, if you search for like Firebase Unity, you'll probably find me. There's a playlist on the official Firebase channel for all our Unity videos. So there's some good resources to find those. And it's just, you know, Firebase recently has been really pushing into games. Like I think I'm the first games focused DA, I guess. Like, I don't quite know everything they did before I joined. So I've only had about a year to, I guess, learn what it is to be a developer advocate versus like a software engineer as I'd been before, and then try to spin up on building useful content for people. Now, I've been to like, you know, gave a GDC talk and Google I/O, or as I like to say, Google I/O, should start that. Yeah. Give a few talks at those, but still ramping up.
I found Firebase a lot harder to get started with than just writing SQL and connecting it to I was using Cold Fusion back in the day, but it's a lot harder than SQL Firebase, I find, the query stuff.
In what ways? I'm going to DM mode, but what do you find hard kind of in the Firebase realm?
If I look at the code that I write just to like iterate through a bunch of users and extract their username, it's like on SQL it'll be like select all from this table, join with this table. Right. Firebase, it's like I get a list of users and I create a list of promises to get the value and then read the value once from each one of them, kind of deal. Because like a join, cool. Two table join, you know.
Yeah. So are you were you saying you're doing this straight up in C or?
No, I'm doing it in JavaScript.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Unfortunately, I can't help as much there, but I guess in Unity, you can. Let's see, how would I do that? I mean, with Firestore, I think you can do more targeted query stuff. Hold on.
I think it's just a general NoSQL that's taking me a while to get the hang of versus just SQL. You
know? Oh yeah, yeah. No, sorry. I was like about to sneeze and then I didn't. The worst.
Oh yeah.
But I think with Firestore you can do. So I haven't spun up as much on Firestore yet because it's just entered public alpha. So I still can't make videos on it. And the way I really, really learn the internal workings of a product are when I start making my videos and just digging into the code and being like, how do things work? Since I work at Google, I can actually dig into the source code and figure out like what is actually the fastest way to do a thing. And in my video, I'm like, do it this way, not that way. I think Firestore.
Yeah, Nigel?
What was that?
Well, I sometimes get a bit confused with the difference between Datastore and Firestore, and I'm the only reason I'm using Firebase is that it's like it seems like the lowest priority empty, but I'm not using any of the real time data features where so I could just have used Datastore, but the Firebase site looked nicer, so that's why I'm using it. You know?
Oh yeah, no. It gets like because ostensibly you could say Firebase has three database solutions, all of various state of NoSQL, right?
Yeah.
Because you have cloud storage, which is really a key value store, right? So it's like it's basically a dictionary, but in the cloud. So you have a string, which is your path, and then just arbitrary binary data at the end of it. You have real-time database, which it sounds like is what you're using. That kind of the metaphor for interacting with it is it's a giant JSON document. So it gets as someone who hasn't done much SQL programming, I super like it because I can just attach listeners to a node and have the Unity JSON serializer read to and from that. Like if you're actually shipping a game, you'd want to use something with slightly better error checking, but you can still use out of the box like C# stuff, and like you just shove data into an object, it syncs up, and like then when it changes, it's like you can rig it up to sync back down.
I'm basically building a very simple social network called MentorsCV.com. Yeah. People can see who the mentors are. So don't need any of that real time stuff, you know, because no one's going to change their mentors every 2 days or every second. You know, it's like.
Yeah. No, and then like Firestore is the other one, which is, I guess, much newer and probably actually better for your use case because. Its metaphor is kind of a hybrid of the two. You have documents at different paths. So like, you know, you kind of have the key, which is the location of the document. The document itself is a JSON object. So, and I haven't dug as much into the like programming interface yet, but I know that there's basic like queries you could do. So maybe you could do like the pull out all the names from the users thing, but, with real-time databases, it'd be, you know, much more convenient if you had a architecture, which I'm not saying you're doing it wrong. This is just like, if I were making a game with real-time database and I had like that sort of thing where I had a bunch of players and needed to pull out their email addresses, I'd probably just spawn a bunch of player objects in my game world and have each one hooked up to like a value change listener, and then when I wanted to get like all the player names, I would just iterate over my local memory rather than having to wait for these features to sync down. I don't know the web interface as well, but the thing that makes real-time database really useful and for some cases and not useful for others, if you were just like, say, like if you had like all your mentors up and you're constantly synchronizing them, which is not what you're doing, what's really cool is when you hook up a value change listener, it hits your local cache first and then eventually syncs with the server if it's different. So you get like a response immediately for like the game client SDKs. So you can just like, what we were talking about before, right, with like syncing your local state to the server state and like rectifying it over time, it kind of does that where like I would say, hey, hook up to this player, and I'll just hook up to whatever the last known state of the player was. Then when the server eventually syncs, I'll get like an event coming all the way down for me to like update, and if somebody else starts poking at that value, I just get like updates like streaming down into my into the game I'm running in Firebase.
So if there's like a server update, it pushes some timestamp to the local object, and then if you query the local object and the timestamp's different, then you query the server. Is that what you're saying?
Well, all of that's obfuscated away. So all you say is like, let's say player Bob, I'll like, you know, create an entity in the world for Bob and just set a value change listener. And the value change listener first fires with whatever's in local cache, and whenever the cache gets changed, so as it's syncing with the server and like ostensibly real time, just that player, like, you know, position or color or whatever else will just keep getting updated as it goes. It's a kind of thing I should warn about if anyone's like listening to this and thinks like, hey, I'm going to make World of Warcraft with real time database. It's not that fast. Or mostly like, get it, like if I got into the technical details, it's like it really is a database, whereas like if you're making like you know, a game server or something, you probably don't care about every packet. You're probably building on UDP and want to minimize ping even more, or minimize latency even more. But it's the kind of thing where you can just like stream these up, like you just attach a listener and just updates happen as fast as they humanly can, while also keeping all the other guarantees you want of a database, like having like effectively atomic writes or making sure data is stable and stuff.
Yeah. My mind was wandering into like how things have changed when we were kids. So when we were kids, we had like 10 or so games that everybody knew about on their console that you could talk to the person at your school and say, what level are you on? But nowadays there's so many games, it's like, it's very hard to find people that locally, yet that play the same game. Usually, your friends are all over the world because it's like a niche game. You know, like Rome, Total War. I'd be like, who plays? How many people play that you know personally, like in the same local area?
You know, it's. I feel like you can kind of get that with major releases, but I'm really weird in that I play a lot of indie games. So, like, I definitely was hanging around gaming channels when, like, you know, like Control came out, and I'm like, man, I really want to play like Control and talk with all of y'all, but I don't have time for a big game like this right now.
There's literally a full game that's released every day, pretty much. There must be at least 365 games released a year.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, the number of like game releases are staggering. I'm trying to think back. I attended a talk once that you know they pulled out some stat like there are like multiple hundreds of games released a day on like a lot of these platforms, and like you know it's really hard to stand out in like that group. And kind of what they were talking about, like the whole point of the talk I was at is like how to approach game design scientifically so that you can never guarantee a hit, but to improve your chances that you are going to like create a hit game and then stuff like that. But it's like really hard area to get into, and you really have to you need to be really good at both reading what the market wants like at this moment, and then also being able to put a spin on it that is both unique to you and your game, but also hard for someone to communicate, right? Because like you know the failure cases are either like, A, I really like this one AAA game, I'm just going to make that on an indie budget and then get completely owned because I don't have like literally hundreds of like man hours to like throw at it. Order magnitude off. Or like your other failure case is you make something truly unique and then somebody clones it in like a day. And like talking about, you know, game studios I've talked to when looking for jobs and like really turned me off. There was one I remember talking to that their entire business model was just to look at what the top game in the App Store was, spend a month cloning it, and then go on to the next like top game the next month. This sounds terrible, but they're staying in business, and this is like the worst.
Yeah, and also there's so many games out there that the player bases must be coming smaller and smaller because they're fragmented and cost more games, apart from the big AAA ones.
It's hard. Like, I think it's like there are two sides to it, because on the one hand, there are more people playing games than ever before. Like, I'm going to come off as like kind of sounding self-contradictory when I say stuff like I'm still a gamer, or like not a core gamer or something, but in a way you could argue that almost everybody in the world now is like a gamer in some form. It might not be like what we'd necessarily consider a traditional gamer, but like everybody has a cell phone and everyone's probably playing a cell phone game. Or like, you know, for a while the PlayStation 3 was one of the best Blu-ray players you can get. So a lot of people had like PlayStations just because they wanted to watch Blu-rays or something. So they're like a lot, there's a huge addressable market for like games now, so a lot of players. But also especially like multiplayer games are so driven by like the communities. Like if you don't have enough players playing to create kind of a fair match, and that no one's going to like your game really. So like that's kind of like a double-edged sword where you need to like get and keep the mind share somehow.
Yeah, but I think just becoming an indie developer just seems like so much risk. Yeah. And the ones that you hear about are the ones that are successful, and the ones that you hear about that almost failed are the ones that are successful, because otherwise they wouldn't be on Netflix talking about their game, like, you know, Super Meat Boy or whatever. But these guys worked so hard, and they're so close to just like, you know, coming up with nothing. You know, it's like,
No, it's It's hard because, like, you know, I still talk to, I'm much more plugged in with like the indie game community than I am like with the big AAA game community, just as a factor of me always working for small companies and on mobile. But it's hard because you see so many people trying and putting so much effort into it and like failing. But also, a lot of people I know who do stick through it find some form of success. Especially like if you're like really passionate and are thinking about this a lot, and in no way am I advocating like crunch, like foot down right now, crunch is bad, avoid that if you possibly can. But if you're like really into games, really like games and like play them a lot and have gone as far as have like some engineering or technical skill, it's like you can probably power through and make something interesting. And the barrier of entry that you can see, like the barrier of entry is dropping in radical ways. You can feasibly build and ship a game now without writing any code and like, you know, effectively ship a award-winning game like that, which when I first entered the industry was pretty much impossible. Like my first job at Venon, part of it was maintaining a game engine just because there weren't any really good game engines that could do what ours did on mobile, but that was like a lot of work. Whereas now, like, you know, most developers, especially on mobile, are probably using Unity. So like they're not even thinking at the same level of abstraction that I had to think at back then, which is great because now you get so many more games that so many more people are making. Makes the market harder to address, right? Because there are more games flooding in. But if you do really have a good idea, you can execute on it yourself and like go into the market, and then I go, I don't know, turn this into a pitch for Firebase. There are tools you can like use to like gauge how well games are doing and tweak them. Both from Google and from other companies, but like, you can use stuff like analytics and analytics and remote config to really like gauge how well your game's doing and like tweak it in real time with your players. And I think like almost like with all these like real time database things you've probably been looking at and stuff, it gives you a way forward. Sorry, I'm just like vomiting like random thoughts right now.
Oh,
So
this is
if I rewind.
normal Miko style podcast anyway, so it's
Yeah.
okay. It's like how I
If
it's
I
yeah, on you It's sort of
Yeah,
like a
no.
date
If I
table, you know,
re
like all the foods out there at once, and you
Yeah.
just pick what you want when you
Oh
want.
yeah. Yeah, no. If I like rewind a second, like going back to the so many things out there thing, it's like it's hard, but I've completely lost my train of thought now. This is the worst.
So when it comes to like game engine, I
Yeah.
hear what you're saying, because when I made that my YouTube series on Space Invaders, that was fun, a one player game. I could have made a two
Yeah.
player game as well. It would be real, it's relatively easy. But when it comes to two player online, I realized this is not going to be simple. And the other one I tried to make, the
Yeah.
Density Wars, where it's 3D in Babylon, and I was going to have all these circles, a sort of unique idea for an RTS game. But then I realized I'm basically going to have to write an engine here
Yeah.
to get this thing to work properly, and I just realized this is going to take me weeks and weeks, and that's why the YouTube's sitting there. So the first few videos were actually quite well received, but I've just not done a development on it for like years. So
Oh yeah. No, and it's so hard too, like at least if you're like me, I really find the engine work the most fun, but it's
yeah.
also the least I don't know, the least fiscally viable, I would say now. Like if I were to go out and like say I needed to make a game and I needed to make money doing it, I would not start by making a game engine. I would start by like buying Unity or Unreal or
Yeah,
like firing up Thiefold or
I
something.
wrote that Space Invaders game. I didn't use any graphics library. I just used all vanilla JavaScript. I wrote all the timing and all that kind of stuff and the update loops. And I'm sort of purist in that I don't want to use someone else's code that I didn't write. I've always had that problem with games.
Yeah. Oh no, I totally get that. And like I don't know. You get like really weird really fun but really weird stories out of that. Like just talking about timing, I remember one game I was working on. This was like a student game. We discovered that it only ran at a smooth frame rate if we opened Windows Media Player. We're like, why is this a thing? It turned out that there's a timer in Windows called the multimedia timer, which is like, you know, one of the accurate high frequency timers you can use for like timing a game loop. There's only one for your entire operating system, though. So anybody who wants to use it has to set it. We just didn't set it, but Windows Media Player did. So Windows Media Player would be like, you know, we need a timer that's accurate to like 1/60th of a second or something like that. So suddenly by saying like, and time like these frames out to be a 1/60th of a second, it started working versus like before, you know, the timer just wasn't accurate. Kind of a little ahead, a little behind. So, yeah.
I mean, using that game engine to write a game, like, okay, this put this rectangle there, and we drag it, and it drags on someone on the screen. And you want to scream to people? Do you know how hard that? Do you know what's going on down there? You're cheating, so and so.
Oh no! Like, I remember. I've done that picking problem when. When I first started game development, so I was like, you know, in middle school or something, making my first games, I thought like the hardest thing in the world was just like selecting something, especially in 3D. I'm like, I read about the Painter's algorithm, and that's like the one I used, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but basically you render like every selectable triangle out to screen as a different color. So you only get like, you know, 65,000 different points you can select or something like that. Okay. You would just like check the color under the mouse cursor and get the thing. And it turns out like, man,
that's crazy.
The correct thing to do that like I know now is like really you just clever, run your what?
That's really clever. That's a really clever solution. Yeah.
It's clever and it doesn't require knowledge of the 3D rendering pipeline, which is key for a middle schooler or probably key for like most people, right? Like the only reason why I know how to like construct a view transform is because like I entered the games industry at a time when you needed to like do that stuff. Like, but the actual correct thing to do is like build your transform stack in reverse and then, you have to choose a point, so you'll typically choose like a point on the near view plane or something, and then like a direction, which encoding directions through the projection matrix gets kind of funky. But if you do that, you get basically a world ray, and then what you want to do is run like array intersection routine to just find the first triangle it hits. And typically that turns out to be more efficient and more flexible than, you know, the Painter's algorithm, but not always.
Yeah, well, my Space Invaders game was just keyboard commands, and everything was, there was a sort of world state, and everything was rendered every single frame, and the keyboard would just adjust the velocity of the ship, and there was like bullets that were like bullets arrays from the other Space Invaders. But the 3D game I tried to write was using Babylon.js, which just had a inbuilt system where you clicked on an object and it just selected the object. And I'd never thought about there was actually combo. I almost thought it was like a native feature of the browser, like you click on an element, it just gives you an on click event, you know. But it's not that simple.
Yeah.
Dealing with an arbitrary screen of data.
And it gets really hard because so I don't know what Babylon does, but oftentimes in games, there are multiple ways to visually represent, there are multiple ways to represent an object, right? So you probably, if you're looking at like a normal player and like a first person shooter or something, you probably at least have like the 3D model that's like, you know, kind of the outline of the player, what you see like rendered. And then you typically have like a completely different model that's like the physics geometry. So all of a sudden when you start talking about picking, it's like, do you want to pick against the actual physical model, or do you want to pick against the physics model, which one might be more accurate if you're like, you know, you might be able to like click between the arm and the body of a player and select what's behind them. you're doing against like visible geometry. But like, you know, physical geometry is what actually intersects and is usually easier to process like ray intersections with, because like the geometry you choose is usually has like a ray intercept procedure for a physics engine. So like that could get faster to choose at that. And then you also have like the issue, if you're going against like visible geometry, whether or not its actual pose is computed like in system RAM, or if you're doing like, you know, GPU skinning or something, and then which you could just reapply the transforms, but it could be slightly different. And then you also have like the LED to pick against, so you have to figure out like which LED you're rendering if you have that in your engine. So like it becomes an interesting problem sometimes. Yeah. Depending on your game.
Yeah, cool, buddy. Well, anything else you want to share with the listeners before we wrap it up?
I don't know. Nothing in particular. I did a very bad job of talking about Firebase, but it's cool and it's there. You should use
absolutely.
It. We make games. Job, I think about games. but yeah, no. Overall, this was fun. And yeah.
Oh, we'll do it again. You're now a part of this super secret Discord server that nobody gets invited to unless they're on the show.
Huzzah!
So we'll probably have some interesting if this thing people actually use this chat for any reason, we'll have some interesting conversations. I've got some other Google people that probably get in here. I'm just exhausted. I've been podcasting today, but we had the Purple Rain live on my show, which is nice, and did a full day's work with a client, so I'm just ready to crash.
Oh yeah, no, I totally get it, and it's much later out there for you, right? Like it's 3 PM for me, so
yeah, it's 11 o'clock. But yeah, I'm going to avoid doing two podcasts in a row. It's quite hard.
Oh yeah, I can get it. That's a lot of talking.
Yeah, usually one in the morning, one in the evening, but I think one a day is enough. I think.
Yeah.
But it's been great to have you on the show, Patrick.
Oh yeah, no. Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, we'll probably catch up, and I'll send you that. I'll send you that code that was the videos I was making. You can have a look at it and let me know what you think.
Oh yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Patrick, that was great to talk to you.
Oh yeah, no. Great talking to you. Thanks again for having me. Yeah.
All right, everybody, that was Patrick Martin from Google and Firebase Google Developer Advocate, talking about Firebase and gaming and a lot of philosophy around gaming as well. So anyway, see you guys shortly on Learn With Us. Have a safe morning, evening, afternoon, wherever you're at. Bye-bye.